Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Happy Monday and welcome to earnings season.
What should we be looking for as companies report?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hello from American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, January 10th. Coming up, the people of southern Sudan go to the polls to vote on independence, and there are some big economic implications. Also, one business we all frequent could soon be able to minimize a sound all the customers seem to hate.
But first, let's get to corporate earnings and what they might tell us about the health of the economy. This week, we'll hear from the aluminum company Alcoa and the chipmaker Intel. Julia Coronado is chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us now, as she is every Monday, to dig into all these corporate earnings. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are you expecting to see as we start to see companies report how they did in the final quarter of 2010?
Well, I think 2010 ended on a reasonably positive note. And so on balance, I think we're going to see some pretty good numbers coming out of this season. But what I'm going to be looking for is not so much what they say about sales in 2010 or at the end of 2010, but how they guide our expectations going into 2011.
And what specifically are you going to be looking for? Because, yes, as you say, companies, when they come out with their earnings, they also tell us what they're looking for next year.
Yes, exactly. And so what they're going to tell us is something about what they expect to happen to sales, so the amount of stuff that they sell, but also what is happening to what they pay for production. So what they're paying for energy and labor and other things that they need to combine to make the products that they sell. And what we're seeing is that companies are spending a lot more on those costs for energy, agricultural inputs, wages and salaries for workers overseas specifically, not so much in the U.S. And the real question is, can they pass those higher costs that they're paying on to consumers? And right now, the pricing power for companies in the U.S. is very low, and consumers are price sensitive. So the question is, are we going to see profits get squeezed in 2011?
All right. We'll be watching to see what happens. Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Verizon Wireless is getting ready for a major announcement tomorrow. And the word is, 4 years after Apple introduced the iPhone, it may now be available on more than one U.S. carrier. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
That one carrier has been AT&T. And AT&T hasn't exactly had the best reputation these last few years.
The cell phone coverage is notoriously poor.
Laura DiDio is with Information Technology Intelligence Consulting. She says a Verizon iPhone could bring with it better deals for consumers.
Verizon is going to really try and make the most of this opportunity by offering, you know, even more bundles than they have been.
Apple reportedly sold more than 45 million iPhones last year. Tech analyst Rob Enderle says with Verizon, those sales could double.
I think it's very clear that Apple needs to get around AT&T if they want to grow their market and grow it significantly.
Enderle says the deal has taken so long because Verizon and Apple have some history.
Apple went to Verizon before they went to AT&T, and Verizon basically laughed them out of the office. And ever since then, they haven't been willing to let them back in again.
Funny how a blockbuster phone can change the mind. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Today, Visteon, a car parts maker that was once part of Ford, is trading on the New York Stock Exchange once again. The company spent a little more than a year in bankruptcy and emerged in October. As Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, Visteon's return to the stock exchange is one more sign that the auto industry is regaining some traction.
During the financial crisis, it seemed like the auto parts business really could collapse. But it didn't. The auto industry is making a comeback, and parts makers are going along for the ride. Kim Korth runs a consulting company called IRN.
They reduced so much of their capacity and their cost structure during the downturn that when the industry came back much stronger than people expected, they're just making a lot of money right now.
It's similar to what we saw in the auto industry. Companies shut plants, laid off workers, and cut costs, and now they're earning more money with lower production. John Hanke is at a consultancy called Planning Perspectives, which works with parts makers. He says suppliers are doing better, but a lot of them are still being cautious.
They're just not going to hire. They're going to just expand production using the same people because we just are too uncertain.
He says they're worried about getting access to credit, and they're afraid the car market's recovery could still stall. I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, Congress is putting off its scheduled business this week in the wake of Saturday's tragic shooting in Arizona. But some government work does go on.
Today, the Consumer Product Safety Commission is going forward with a controversial plan to publicize the thousands of complaints it receives every year about defective products. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The Product Safety Agency will post complaints about defective merchandise within 15 days of receiving them. Consumer groups say that'll help warn customers about everything from dangerous baby cribs to toxic drywall. Right now, the public has only limited access to complaints, and consumer advocates say it takes too long to figure out trends that expose defective products. But Rosario Palmieri at the National Association of Manufacturers says there are no safeguards to make sure the complaints aren't made by competitors or even trial lawyers looking for business.
We fear that some with political or financial motives might use this database as an opportunity to falsely malign particular products, companies, or brands.
The CPSC says companies will be protected from false accusations or the disclosure of business secrets, and manufacturers' responses will be listed alongside each complaint. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I don't know about you, Jeremy, but when I go to the dentist, I can think of a whole bunch of things that are going to make me uncomfortable. Like this. Take a listen. Take a listen. Just makes your skin crawl, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
The eerie sound of the dentist drill, Jeremy, could be a thing of the past. A researcher at King's Dental Institute in London developed this MP3 device that allows patients to hear music, and they'll be able to hear the dentist as well. But it'll cancel out the sound of the drill. They're going to use noise-canceling technology. Yeah. The developers are now hoping there are investors looking to get involved in the project, help it along. Those who, of course, are chomping at the bit. You're listening to the Midday Update for January 10th, a Monday. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Today is the second day of a week-long referendum asking people in southern Sudan if they want independence from the country's government in Khartoum. The vote is part of an agreement ending years of civil war, and the referendum carries big economic implications for both the North and the South. The BBC's James Copnall joins us now from Khartoum with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us a sense of the mood there in both the North and the South as this historic vote continues.
Well, I think the mood in the South can only really be described as euphoric. Southerners have waited, in some cases, decades, gone through two very bitter civil wars, the second one of which cost 2 million lives, and now they feel they have their chance to decide their future, which will almost certainly be independence. The mood in the North is much more downbeat, people coming to the realization that a large part of their country, and indeed of their economy, is about to split away. They love to say that Sudan is Africa's biggest country, 1 million square miles. Well, not for much longer.
And it's also one of Africa's biggest oil producers. What are the economic implications here?
Potentially, the implications are very damaging for northern Sudan. The south accounts for almost three-quarters of Sudan's oil. That oil, then, revenue is going to disappear from northern banks. The one consolation for the north is that the economic infrastructures go through the north, the refineries, the pipelines. So there'll probably be some sort of deal between both sides on economic grounds. But the northern economy will take a real blow. Already, the finance minister has said that they won't be able to pay subsidies on foodstuffs and other imported goods to help out a beleaguered population. And the South, well, it will have to diversify away from oil, which represents about 97% of its revenue, because the oil is slated to run out in 20 to 30 years.
The BBC's James Copnall in Khartoum, Sudan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To an oil story in another part of the world now. The markets today braced for a big surge in prices following a pipeline leak that was discovered Saturday in Alaska. Now, that's a leak that shut down all production in North America's biggest oil field. But the price of oil today was up only modestly. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
What happened in Alaska?
A leak was discovered in a pumping station on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. This is the only pipeline that carries oil from Prudhoe Bay down to the port of Valdez, 800 miles away. From there, of course, it's pumped, it's shipped out by tankers. This is not a huge leak. Only 10 barrels of oil apparently leaked into this pumping station, but this is a 640,000 barrel a day pipeline, and much of that flow has now been halted while BP and other companies investigate the leak.
So has the shutdown interrupted supply to the market? Are we going to see higher prices because of this?
Well, not yet. There are about 2.5 million barrels in storage in Valdez, so the ships are still able to come in and fill up and keep the market supplied. But that 2.5 million barrels will keep the ships busy for only about 4 days. If the pipeline is shut for longer than that, then we could all be paying much more for our gasoline. Here's oil analyst Nick McGregor of Brokers Redmayne Bentley.
If this requires a prolonged shutdown of the pipeline, which carries about 15% of US oil production, then it could have an impact on prices globally as people look to buy elsewhere to take up the slack.
Some analysts are saying that if the pipeline shutdown lasts very much longer than a week, the oil price could rocket to well over $100 a barrel.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard with us from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Here in the U.S., the debate about economic growth usually centers on cutting taxes. But in China, there's a move to raise taxes because economic growth, officials say, is a little too hot. One of China's biggest cities will be the country's first to collect residential property taxes, as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Yep, you heard right. Chinese homeowners don't have to pay annual property taxes. And it's been great for the real estate business. A little too great.
You hear stories of people buying 2, 3, maybe even 20 apartments that are empty.
Patrick Shavonik teaches business at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He says that in the U.S., you might think twice about buying, say, a dozen high-rise condos. Property taxes might be a little rough. Not so in China, and that's produced a buying frenzy that's pushed prices through the pointy high-rise roofs in China's big cities, making the government worry there's a bubble. In March, the city of Chongqing will start taxing high-end residential property. Shanghai is rumored to follow suit later this year. Shavonik says the taxes may be more effective in becoming an alternative source of revenue for local governments, which have never had the right to collect them. The local officials in Chongqing shouldn't hold their breath. Unconfirmed reports say the new tax rate there will be around 1%. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, January 10th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
Lawmakers in Texas gather today for a new legislative session. And they have a Lone Star-sized problem, a budget deficit of at least $15 billion. It's a different economic picture these days for Texas. In the early days of the recession, the state was seen as a big bright spot. From station KUT in Austin, Ben Philpott reports.
In 2008, as some states were shedding thousands of jobs, Texas was still adding. In 2009, when millions and billions of dollars were being cut from many state budgets, Texas increased spending. Talmadge Heflin says the state is doing great.
As compared to other states, and many times they won't say that. They will just say, Texas is doing so good.
Heflin writes budget policy at the conservative think tank, the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That idea of Super Texas got a boost during the 2010 elections, as Governor Rick Perry campaigned on a message of economic success.
We've cut taxes for small business, balanced our budgets, set aside $8 billion for a rainy day.
What Texans didn't hear in November is that $8 billion isn't enough to replace the federal stimulus dollars the state received in 2009. And Texas doesn't have a state income tax. Dick Levine says that means Texas relies heavily on sales taxes, which he says leads to boom or bust revenues. Levine is with the Center for Public Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank.
The trouble is that those taxes don't grow naturally with the economy. They don't grow as quickly as our growth in needs, especially given our unusually young population.
What the state does to get out of its very real budget crisis could compound the problem. Cut too much from the budget, and some fear basic infrastructure and social safety nets will crumble in an already low-spending state. Raise taxes too much, and the economic engine that creates jobs could seize up. Heflin, again, says it's all relative.
We didn't escape the downturn, but I still say the bloom is not off the rose. It's still there.
So the rose, yellow, of course, blooms on. I'm Ben Philpott for Marketplace.
Tonight, Oregon and Auburn will square off in college football's BCS championship game. Steve, you're going to be watching that?
I will be. Auburn's from my home state of Alabama.
Absolutely. Yeah. But before a single player has stepped onto the field tonight, Steve, many fans have already tasted defeat.
Uh-oh.
That's because the ticket-selling website StubHub allowed hundreds of tickets to be sold, even though they never actually existed.
Mm.
From Oregon Public Broadcasting, David Nogueras reports.
If you're looking to go to a sold-out sports event or music concert, and you're not comfortable buying a scalped ticket in the parking lot, thanks to the internet, there are options. StubHub is one of the big players. This year's BCS title had been shaping up to be the biggest moneymaker in the history of StubHub. Head of communications Glenn Lehrman says that all changed when sellers began to let them know they didn't actually have some of the tickets they sold.
And ordinarily, you know, if something like this happens, we're able to source the tickets from, you know, a variety of locations and able to take care of that. But in this instance, because tickets had become so expensive and so scarce, it was just almost impossible at this point.
With an average cost of $1,100 a ticket, StubHub did something it had never done before. It shut down the event on its site and emailed customers who already received their tickets, offering to buy them back for three times what they paid. StubHub now says they bought back enough tickets to cover all the unfulfilled orders. How much did that cost?
I can't give exact numbers, but let's just say it's a lot of money.
But then again, the secondary ticket market brings in about $3 billion a year. Sucharita Malpuru is an analyst for Forrester Research. She says at the center of that market are the ticket brokers.
A lot of these brokers have relationships with season ticket holders that they think that they can take advantage of. And sometimes in cases like this, situations get a little bit out of hand.
None of the brokers contacted for the story would agree to go on the air, but one said it's common for brokers to sell tickets they don't have, with the hope of buying them cheaper later on from panicky sellers. It's kind of like a short sale. But this guy's company lost about $80,000 because not enough fans were willing to part with their tickets, no matter how high prices got. In Oregon, I'm David Nogueras for Marketplace.
And finally, from football tickets to movie tickets, you'd think in 2011 we'd probably be flocking to the theaters to see films about, I don't know, internet startups or aliens or futuristic stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, no, that is not the case. The top movie at the box office over the weekend was True Grit.
Huh.
Have you seen that yet?
I did. I saw the. I've seen the version with John Wayne in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, years ago, man. It's absolutely.
Have you seen the new one with Jeff Bridges and Matt Damon?
Oh, they've come out with a new one. No.
Well, that Coen Brothers movie has brought in $110 million so far. It is the first Western to top $100 million since Unforgiven and Dances with Wolves back in the 90s.
Wow, amazing!
I know. Things are changing, and I'm just wondering if the main character's name, Rooster Cogburn, is going to become a big name for kids that are born in 2011.
We're going to find out. We'll find out in October. Absolutely. Rooster.
Rooster in New York. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Rooster Chiatakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.